All right, thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you all for coming today and for the invitation to speak here. I should also thank you for the opportunity to speak first. Often when you're the non-Western person, you're brought in as a rejoinder at the end, you know, to offer the other perspective. So I hope that, you know, this will perhaps keep the non-West kind of in your mind for the rest of the day, I would hope. In the inaugural volume of the Terra Foundation essays, Picturing, which was on the desk yesterday as they spoke, Rachel DeLeu highlights how continental Bildwissenschaft and Anglo-American visual culture were each constructed partially in opposition to the discipline of Western art history. This is a stance, I would argue, that Japanese art history, as a para or subdiscipline, shares. The most thoroughgoing scholarship on the art of East Asia has often had no choice but to be oppositional. Moreover, given the often awkward fit of non-Western artifacts in the discipline of art history, the possibility of an alternative is quite appealing. As this audience is well aware, Hans Belting, among others, has advocated for the creation of a new discourse of the image that would account for the interpenetration, interaction, and interdependence of the somatically mediated image, hence doing away with the illusion of any internal, external, or endogenous, exogenous distinction. According to his Anthropology, the most conspicuous formulation of Bildwissenschaft available in English, the human body is itself a living medium, and no image exists without a body to activate it. Throughout his career, Belting has been diligent in noting that a limiting factor in such an enterprise is its Eurocentric episteme. In his words, quote, "The question of what an image is remains a rather narrow inquiry, so long as it does not explore the notion of images in cultures other than our own," end quotes. In the next 20 minutes or so, I'd like to do just that, to give a tentative conspectus of what an image theory might look like from a pre-modern Japanese perspective. In order to achieve this, the talk will proceed in three parts. First, I would like to attempt a rough mapping of the terms of Bildwissenschaft onto the emic pre-modern Japanese terminology of the image. Second, I will evoke a ritual known as the ajikan, according to which one is directed to inscribe an image inside of one's own mind. And then third, so used to tapping the computer for that. Third, I will apply this to the interpretation of a 14th century feretory, which will serve as the prime object of analysis. I'm keen to demonstrate this morning that this feretory represents an elaborate mechanism, a dispositif, that utilized the mediation of the image in the body in order to make doctrinal truth about the nature of the human mind apparent. Moreover, it did so by short-circuiting or collapsing the illusory division between the internal image and the reified external one. In terms of method, the theory proposed here is derived from the materiality of the object, not text alone. Thus, it speaks to the notion raised yesterday of objects that generate their own image theories. One might even go so far as to argue that this feretory is evidence of an alternative, pre-modern... Well, if I read more slowly, I might run over time. But all right. All right. So I'll perhaps then cut and speak more casually at times then to speed things along too. So I might go even so far as to note that the feretory is evidence of an alternative, pre-modern, non-Western, and high-stakes image theory that puts soteriological rather than academic ends first. It must be noted that the impetus of this talk is not the globalization of art history. Japan has long occupied a privileged place in the history of the discipline of art history and literary theory. Take, for example, such a seminal figure as Franz Wickoff, who argued as early as 1895 that there were only two grand historical streams of pictorial art in the world, that of Western and Eastern Eurasia, and he designated Japanese painting as the highest expression of the East Asiatic style, which was only then, he argued, at the end of the 19th century, being brought back into dialogue with European pictoriality. Art history, as a discipline, has never been concerned only with the West, and I don't mean to preach to this audience, you all know this very well. But alterity is implicit in its structure and developments on both sides of the Eurasian continent. Nevertheless, as Belting again rightly noted, quote, "We do not seriously credit the local genealogies of art of image production, art, as compatible with the history of the Western type, although to give an example, China and Japan both possess older traditions of art literature and art collection than the West. Are these genealogies still viable, or will they be annihilated by a misunderstood modernism?" He continues, "Perhaps they will survive in a transformation that we, with the compass of our practice cliches, will not even recognize," end quote. Yet the epistemic collisions that Belting prophesies for the future of our discipline have happened long ago in Japan, and Japanese art history represents a discursive site where, despite lexical hybridity, the emic lexical genealogy remains identifiable in the archive. In other words, to find an alternative image theory, I suggest we stop looking for old Chinese words to put up against old Latin and old Greek words, and instead look at the modern living discourse of the image used in non-Western contexts. The Japanese lexical adaptation of Western terms of image analysis has been thoroughly studied by the Japanese scholar Sato Doshin, whose main thesis was that the creation of the term painting in Japan affected a sort of epistemic violence that displaced what were before more nuanced vocabularies for the discussion of visual artifacts. Sato began his inquiry with a look into the etymology of the word bijutsu, fine arts. He drew upon the research of Kitazawa Noriaki and others and argued that art did not exist until it was discursively constructed in the 1870s. Now, this is a familiar trope. It's not, you know, the birth of art in many contexts has been analyzed. The neologism was a calque from the German Kunstgewerbe and was coined in preparation for Japan's participation in the Vienna International Exhibition of 1873. I fear, however, that Sato's inquiry is open to criticism on the grounds of Occidentalism, since art, as a subject of scientific and academic inquiry, was also a contested concept in Europe and America. Western art was not as monolithic as it may have seemed. Nevertheless, the old terms in Japan did not disappear. They remain current to this day. The result is that Japanese maintains an elaborately ramified and hybrid lexicon for visual phenomena and artifacts. In his analysis, Sato discussed the ways in which pre-modern Japanese pictorial media were framed by focusing upon three terms that could be used individually or incorporated into myriad compound words, and they are zu, e, and ga. And for those more familiar with China, the zu is tu. You often hear discussions of tu, and the ga is hua. So these are the Japanese pronunciations of those terms. As Sato notes, painting was the neologism formed by combining e and ga into a new compound. In Japanese, when e is put into a compound word, its pronunciation changes to kai, so it's kai ga. Time does not permit us to discuss the full implications of this lexical shifting. That's the burden of Sato's work. Nevertheless, it has led me to wonder the following. Is it possible for us to identify within the Japanese lexicon a distinction being made between picture and image, as we see in Anglo-American scholarship, or is it possible to identify a term like built that would operate as both picture and image? More importantly, did these distinctions matter at all? In an effort to answer this, my first instinct was to expand the lexicon to include Buddhist words, which are lacking in Sato's analysis. Within Buddhism and funerary contexts in Japan, we have more terms such as miei, which was a kind of shadow painting. It's kind of like skiography. We have zo, icons, statues, typically of deities. Sho, which simply means form, shape. Mon, bun, which means text or pattern, and later has come to stand for culture itself. Omokage, which is kind of like a figura. It is the trace, the image, and the face. Or mandara, mandaras, as you've probably heard of. These are kind of architectonic diagrams of kind of on cosmological scales often. Now, it's important to note that this is not a neat typology, nor is it complete. There's much overlap between the semantic fields, and as Sato rightly noted, even ga and e have dramatically shifted over the centuries. It's a bit like speculatione evidentia. At times, each of them came to encompass the other to have opposite meanings through the centuries. I am not interested today in attempting to do a comparative etymological analysis of Chinese and Greek and Latin terms for imaging. I mean, such an analysis might prove useful, but it risks the dangerous sense of an Edenic unity or structuralist opposition in early human pictorial thought that I strongly wish to avoid. As for the distinction between image and picture, however, we can approach this question two ways. On the one hand, we could follow Sato's lead in his method of Kotoba no Kenkyu, the study of words. This is a strict Worfian philology, whereby you find the advent of a term, and that marks the advent of the concept. However, I don't buy that, and so I'd prefer to look at the objects themselves rather than going through this philological approach. All of these words refer to forms of picturing, but not all of them can be used with reference to a material object. Now, to further complicate this, both the word picture and image have been adopted into Japanese as well as pikucha in imeji, but their meanings do not map onto how we use them in English. In fact, imeji is most commonly seen on commercial advertising products. It's on like a box of cereal. It will say, shashin wa imeji, the picture or the photograph is an image, as a warning that it may not actually look like what it looks like when you open it. That's what an image means. To complicate things even further, Japan recognizes that the Latinate word image has different meanings based upon where it came from. So you have both imeji from English and imaju from French, from image, and these are separate words in Japanese. To return to the pre-modern terms, however, I'd like to pursue the hypothesis today that it is e, that is the term that most closely correlates with contemporary art historical discourse around the term image. Now, Sato argues that it is ga. He has separate concerns, but as you'll see, I prefer e. Now, the reasons I choose this are as follows. E is polychrome. A defining characteristic of ga was the visibility of the mark or the black brushstroke. By contrast, e does not necessarily need to have a trace. It is a polychrome manifestation less beholden to surface. Ga also relates to writing. This is a main point of Sato's, but e does not need to have sort of a graphical component to it. Second, e is mimetic. As Joshua Mostow has noted in the 12th century literature and diaries, it was common for someone to say he or she looked just like a picture, enokotoshi, or a scene was very much like a picture. That was always e that was used, and that's still the case in Japanese. We say eni naru, enoyo, things look like pictures. I mean, it's the e that we use. So this lets us know that when the phenomenal world accords with the mental world, the alignment of the two is an e. That's where we use this term. Third, the term shows up in meditation texts, and there it's in reference to the object of the visualization, so that is an image. Third, the e seems to be the more intimate term. As Sato argued, e dominated discourse until the 19th century when ga became ascendant due to its foreign, technical, public, and graphical valence. But I would like to suggest also that e did not win in that debate because it seemed too imagistic. They were looking for a term to describe paintings, objects, so they chose ga, not e. E is much more like the image. Given the above, however, the phrase built images, the title of today's talk, may seem to represent an attempt to bridge visual culture Bildwissenschaft by taking advantage of a homonym between English and German, or a pun. In some respects, this is true. Yet, its true referent is actually a little further afield. For built image is the literal translation of the Japanese term tsukurie, which was a type of picturing that involved the application of a series of thick mineral pigments upon an underdrawing executed in ink. Once this elaborate stratigraphy had been erected, so to speak, the final details were then added in black atop the entire construct. Now, what you're looking at here is the Tale of Genji Scroll, which is kind of the manuscript in many ways for the study of classical Japanese painting. You're looking at a detail of this figure's face right here. It's a profile with a large lacquered cap on top, a black lacquered cap. And this shows you at the level of the actual fibers of the paper, which are quite long in Japanese paper compared to Western papermaking traditions. There was a black outline drawn in light ink, and then assistants come in to apply many layers of kind of thick mineral pigments, such as the ground-up shells that you see producing the cheek here. And then a final painter comes in and adds a final layer of black details on top. And then that would be kind of the tiny little bits of brushstroke here for the eye. Little details like that are added at the end. So tsukurie is a construct. It's built up from the surface. Now, often in medieval Japanese texts, when one refers to a picture, this is the sort of picture they have in mind. It's a form of picturing that is processual, that is layered, and is stratigraphic. A further piece of evidence in support of the identity of the English term image and the Japanese term e is that this processual nature extends into visualization literature as well. On such occasions, one is asked to build images in the mind layer by layer by layer, and these are series. You begin with one image, and then once you're able to hold that in mind, you add a second image to it. So it's always a process you follow. You don't simply look and suddenly visualize things. And the Locus Classicus is the story of Queen Vaidehi from the sutra, the Visualization Sutra, as it's called, the Kammuryo Jukyo, a text that dates no later to the early 6th century. In other words, it would seem that somatically embodied images and materially embodied images were both understood as time-bound processes. They were constructs. In light of the false essentialism that sometimes rests beneath the surface of text and image scholarship, this aspect of Japanese image discourse is refreshing in its accuracy. It completely circumvents the optical myth that images enter the mind like reflections, projections, or impressions, and it also counters the tenacious ekphrastic myth articulated most influentially by Lessing, whereby pictures are erroneously defined as those which are immediately perceptible to the eye. I keep wanting to advance on my computer. This brings us to the second part. Now, in order to make the internal operations of the image clear, I would like to introduce one such visualization ritual, as well as the pictorial icons that were used to calibrate, transmit, and prime the mental or somatic image. The ritual at hand is known as the Aji Kan, the ritual of viewing the character A. It involves a visualization of icons such as the two medieval examples you see here. Starting at the bottom is a golden three-pronged vajra, a lightning bolt-shaped ritual implement, on top of which is a reddish-brown lotus blossom and a green seed pod. Slow down. Slow down. I'm a very fast speaker, even naturally. All right, I'll slow down even more. Inside of the seed pod, Enclosed in a round spherical moon disk is yet another open lotus on top of which the character A, the first syllable of Sanskrit, is written in a now defunct script known as Siddham. So the history of this practice is complex. Its textual roots lie in the mid-6th to mid-7th century sutra known as the Vairochana Sutra, and it appears to have been introduced into Japan in the 9th century by the founder of esoteric Japanese Shingon Buddhism, the polymath Kukai. The practice does not become widespread until the 12th century, however, with another monk named Kakuban. Now, I know the iconography of esoteric Buddhism is often just as esoteric as it sounds, and so I'm putting here a three-dimensional reliquary so that you have a sense of what's being depicted in pictorial form. They have similar shapes. This is the lotus pedestal. Then this is the vajra I was talking about, the lightning bolt implement used. This is another kind of multifold lotus shape, a platform. And on top of this here, this is called a flaming jewel, actually, whereas this is a moon disk. But even though it's referred to as a moon disk, it's seen to be three-dimensional, and you can see that on the right. These are depictions of flames on the outside, whereas this one is meant to radiate light. It's not actually on fire in the same way. So the top is slightly different, but the general shape iconographically is similar. What's quite amazing about this, while we have it on the screen, is that it's actually a sensor, too. So incense was here, and then the incense would come out and kind of encircle the reliquary as it was burning. So it was a really amazing artifact when it was in action. Before moving on as well, I should stress that this meditative practice is not a historical artifact. It continues to be practiced today. The advertisement at upper left is from I believe a subway advertisement in Osaka saying, like, do the stressors of modern life have you down? The panacea is to co-perform Ajikan meditation. At bottom is a group of people performing this meditation, and then at right is a screenshot from the Japanese equivalent of Amazon, Rakuten, where you can buy your at-home meditation kit. And written in red here is Urekiremashita. It is completely sold out. So you can see that these are quite successful. Now, in order to give an overview of this ritual, I'd like to return to the 12th century and look at a contemporaneous edition of the visualization instructions included in a luxury manuscript known as the Definition of A. I choose this because it's contemporaneous, but also it was a chapter in my dissertation, so it's convenient for me to reveal the truth. It also gives you a chance to look at the stunning quality of the paper ornamentation of the 12th century, which Japan is well known for. The manuscript comprises two images and five individual texts, and they're sort of collaged together. But today we're only going to be speaking about the first two of these texts, the Definition of A and the Practicalities of the character A, these two. The definition gives both the semiotic and the pragmatic horizons of the A glyph. It is important to begin with a definition since the ritual is based on a homology between the grammatical role of the A and the principle for which it stands doctrinally. My own understanding of this is informed by many scholars who've worked on this before, such as Richard Payne, Takagi Dreitlein, Fabio Rambelli, and Yamasaki Taizo. To sum up an elaborate ritual very succinctly, the A in Sanskrit operates as a negative prefix. This is just as in English, like ahistorical. So as soon as you say A, you're immediately both negating and making meaning at the same time. So it's a self-negating kind of phoneme. The second step is that it's the first letter of the alphabet. It was seen as the alpha. You know, it is the beginning, like the aleph. It marks creation itself, but it marks creation while also undoing it, right, due to the first principle. It also is a character that's used to mark just the motion of the breath. It doesn't have to be a sound. So even breathing, in effect, is a form of writing this character or saying this character out loud. Third, through a mechanism known as seed syllables, the A is seen as an encapsulation of the deity Vairochana, the resplendent one. Vairochana is seen as the ultimate universal Buddha, the Buddha out of which all phenomena radiates, kind of the ultimate principle. Seed syllables is a metaphor, kind of a germinal metaphor, where you see that inside of a single character is kind of the deity is embedded or contained inside of it. In order to use a feretory to explain a feretory, this is another contemporaneous work that kind of makes that quite clear. From Kozanji in Kyoto, this is the Sanskrit A written on the outside, and then you open the doors to find the deity in iconic form inside. So this is Vairochana on the inside. With this well established, let us move to the second text, which describes the way in which one actually performs the ritual. When one is to behold the character for the first time, if the mind has not already mastered it, first the image. Draw a lotus flower, then inside of a moon disk, draw the character A, then one should gaze. When one has achieved full fruition with the visualization practice. Light from the character will scatter out of the chest in the four directions and spread to the 10 directions, extending to all Buddha worlds. The light will travel around the practitioner from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet. Why is it that one envisions 8 petals, not more, not less? In general, the shape of everyone's mind is like that of a lotus flower that is not yet opened. There's a floral axis that splits it into 8 parts. In men, it faces upwards. In women, it faces downwards. If the heart is made clean, that is to say it has become a mandala. It did not arrive from someplace else. This A also did not arrive from some other place, but it is born of the heart. One practices concentration and little by little becomes cleansed, and since the heart is pure, the A will manifest itself inside. First, note that the term used to describe the externally and the internally constructed here is E. Thus, it accords with the proposition with which you began. Second, note that one builds this image. One does not simply visualize it in the mind. One pictures it internally. In the introduction to the Tara essays, and as was explained yesterday by Professor DeBlue, right, we can use picture as a verb, to picture. This is actually incredibly useful and breakthrough for me, because most of the literature in my field has to do with the act of looking and how to describe that, not the actual ontology of the image. It has to do with the process of looking. So I've struggled to find a word to describe that, but picturing seems to work quite well to talk about what you're doing. So one needs to picture this in the mind, not just look at it. Third, if one is new to the practice, one was told to use an icon, to use a picture, to calibrate the mind in its own building of the image. Hence, this ritualized example accords with what Belting formulated when he said, mental images are inscribed in external ones and vice versa. They are, in his words, a support, host, or tool for the image, close quote. Yet, Aji visualization takes this further, since one does not merely see the image, but one must write it and make it inside of oneself. To see the icon correctly is to write it inside of your body using virtual materiality. Physical inscription is made to seem like a dimensionally impoverished metaphor for the replete and robust inscription performed by the mind in its act of viewing. Fourth, the mentally pictured A has primacy. At first, the relationship is bidirectional, but as the external picture is used to calibrate the internal one, but according to the text, one is merely learning to see what is already present inside. In other words, the E is not, as Christopher Wood said in his critique of Belting's work, apparitional. Last, note that Ajikan ritual takes what is assumed to be a passive, unconscious, and automatic process, the everyday picturing of the mind, and turns it into a purposive process one should closely attend to, not just the picturing, but the process of picturing itself. This means that this text is, in Michael Silverstein's terms, a metapragmatic one, and by extension, what it advocates is a sort of metapictoriality. Its goal is to have you become aware of the recursions of pictoriality and visuality that obtain between two differently mediated images, external and internal. Now, thereafter, the manuscript shows two courtiers seated with the envisioned characters written inside of their chests, inscribed on top of efflorescent lotuses that represent their flayed minds. As I've argued elsewhere, these pictures represent a form of semiotic écorché. As the ritual text notes in East Asian physiology, the site of cognition was the heart and not the brain. Now, this holds true in Western medieval, too. Envision, too, was a cognitive process that took place in the heart. Hence, as I would like to argue, we are seeing into the sitter's minds and into the physiological space that is opened within their bodies to allow for three-dimensional imaging. The circles within their bodies are thus a double-layer feature of virtuality. To conclude this section, antecedent to visual studies and independent of Bildwissenschaft, the interdependence of the material picture and the mental image has long been a fundamental aspect of Buddhist visual culture. Scholars such as Alan Sponberg and more recently Robert Scharf and Cynthia Bogle have demonstrated that vision and visualization itself is a false binary in Buddhism. Images were mentally discerned, animated, manipulated, and even respired. As Sponberg notes, the better one learns to see an icon in Buddhist context, the less the distinction between picture and image matters at all. Again, if one turns to the writings of Kukai, the 9th century polymath who authored many of the foundational texts of Japanese Shingon phenomenology, including the definition of a aji that we were looking at earlier, all phenomena were described as illusory marks. As has been examined by Ryuichi Abe, the world is, according to Kukai, always already a picture. And more precisely, Kukai calls the world a type of discourse, and all of its percepts are seen as notations written inside the mind. Thus, we are able to remove any ground between exogenous picture and eidetic image. To put that into a soundbite, essentially the world is already a picture, and when you picture the picture in your mind, you're just making a second picture of the picture. There's no reality to ground it. Nothing is derivative. This brings us to the big question of the section that I will leave unanswered, but if, as Christopher Wood argues, visual culture and Bildwissenschaft represent a turn away from the deep Protestant logocentrism of art history, what are we to make of a visual culture where the inscriptive and depictive mark were not readily distinguished? and Rologos was always a visual and an oral phenomenon. The two were not distinguished at all. This brings us finally to the feretory. With this well established, let us start to analyze this. Whereas any number of artifacts could serve to illustrate Belting's claim that the picture is an apparatus for imaging, I would like to argue that this particular artifact was designed in order to make that aspect of vision itself apparent. Unlatching a very small, lotiform clasp, the heavily lacquered double doors swing open to reveal a triptych. So this is the lotiform clasp. It's in the shape of a lotus. At center is the Saddam A icon, and it's flanked by two deities known as Radiant Kings. On the right is Fudo Myo-o, the immovable one, along with attendant youths, and at left is Gozanze Myo-o, the three-world victor, who's shown trampling Daiji Zaten, who is a Buddhist form of Shiva, along with whom stands sinicized Uma, his consort. The medievalist in me can't resist telling you that all of this is actually cut gold leaf, called kirikane, a medieval Japanese technique where you cut extraordinarily fine strips of gold leaf and then apply them in geometric shapes. So all of this you see is actually gold leaf ornament, creating that kind of grid-like structure underneath it all. Has no bearing on my thesis. So the primary icon, however, is the gilt bronze Ah character set into a polished bronze mirror inserted into a lacquer wooden panel marked with rays of applied gold leaf, each countershaded in paint to give the impression of radiant light. So this is gold leaf and then gold paint on the outside. This is a round mirror in the concentric circles, and then this is cast in gilt bronze Ah in the center. One notices the presence of small crystals and precious stones set into the crevices of the cast script. These are shari, or relics of the Buddha. Now, despite the material difference, the relics and the cast letter are identically bodies of the Buddha, hence their co-location at the center, right? They're different relationships semantically, but they both signify the same thing. That's why they make sense to be together. The removable bronze mirror is bordered by a double ring of bronze, and the entire virtual sphere appears nested on a lotus platform with veins of each petal limned in gold. It is quite small. It measures only 30 centimeters high, which is not coincidentally, perhaps, the height of most medieval Japanese manuscripts. It is now legally protected as patrimony, registered as an important cultural property, and stored in the Nara National Museum. Here is Kyoto for reference. Here is Nara, the museum where it is. And before it had been held at a temple, Kakuanji, which is not far away from where it presently is housed. Now, the feretory is dated to the summer of 1387 on the basis of an inscribed dedicatory paper that is inserted behind the removable mirror. So this is an overlay of what it looks like when you take it out. The only image I could find was black and white. But when you remove the mirror, you see the inscription here. This tells you the time of year. This tells you the name of what kind of object it is. And it's the fourth year of Shitoku. So we know that it's 1387 quite precisely. On iconographic grounds, it's apparent that the central panel of the feretory represents a material remediation of the painted icons we saw earlier. To use the same trick as before, here's a censer to make that three-dimensional shape clear. We don't have the Vajra anymore, but you see that what this is a two-dimensional representation, roughly, of this kind of three-dimensional shape, more or less. Let us direct our attention, however, upon the pragmatic consequences of the material remediation itself. By casting the A in bronze, it obtains an extraordinary permanence that accords well with its semantic function as the foundation of all possible semiosis. Yet its hue and materiality cause it to play with light in such a way that writing, now rent from all trace of ductus or hand, is made to seem like a type of archaeopoetic chrysography, a word written in light, with imminent radiance but ephemeral substance. The mirror into which the cast character is set also partakes of this radiance. Now, this is because pre-modern mirrors in bronze, when polished, still retain a golden hue when you reflect them. You don't have 100% reflectivity as we're used to. So no matter what you see will seem golden in the mirror. And this accords with the ritual text earlier saying that when you see it correctly, the world will be flooded with gold. So the mirror, the materiality actually helps in that sense for you to see what it says you will. Key question, however, is what world is it that is reflected in the mirror? Now, this allows us to understand the feretory as a mechanism that makes the picturing of the mind visible. For example, if one were standing before the feretory at a distance that would allow one to open the double doors, one would find one's own body reflected in the mirror. Hence, the A would seem to be couched within one's own flesh, imminent inside of one's chest. This accords with the doctrinal understanding of the A as having been permanently present within one's body all along. This interpretation would be strengthened, however, if one were able to identify a constraint that would regulate the body's relationship to the surface of the feretory. This goes back to what Professor Somaini was talking about Benjamin's use of medium yesterday, right? We need a medium to make this actually true. It would appear, however, that such a constraint did exist. At the top of the feretory are two small rings attached to which are golden cords. It's believed that these cords were used to hang the feretory around the neck. Now, it is registered legally. Its legal name in Japan is the neck-hung feretory. If this is true, it has profound consequences, but I have to admit that I'm completely out on a limb. I have to simply trust that name, that this was meant to be hung on the neck. I have no other evidence to say that this really was worn on the body other than that. I want to make that explicit. However, the consequences are so profound that I couldn't resist running through all the entailments that that would bring about. It would mean that the feretory, then, is capable of showing the identity of the image, within two separate bodies. Imagine, if you will, two figures standing opposite one another. The body of one upon whom the feretory hangs, on that body the box acts as a prosthesis. Opening the door, one is given visual access to the interior of the body that is not entirely unlike early modern écorché or the high modern X-ray. To borrow a term from David Summers, it is antimodern. It is a tool for imaging somatic interiority. Yet the feretory exceeds this, since one does not only see into the viscera, but one specifically sees into the organ responsible for vision itself, the heart-mind, and one sees that organ in a state of perpetual perception, splayed open, with the somatically mediated image manifest for you to see. But reductively, we are seeing picturing in both its internal and external components, which are present and confirmable in the absolute identity of the cast A. Structurally speaking, there would be three images, one mediated in metal, one mediated in the body of the beholder, and spatially encapsulated in a reflected image of the beholder's body, and the third in the body of the one upon whom the feretory hangs, a subject whom we presume has this image always already inscribed in his mind. In other words, the wearer of the feretory is in the curious position of not having optical access to the feretory image, but only of others having optical access through the feretory to his own internally mediated image. People can read his mind, quite literally, but he cannot. In other words, the feretory transforms the body upon whom it hangs into a living medium, in Belting's terms, as well as a living mirror. It is the fruition of the fantasy of second sight. How, then, are we to contextualize this within contemporary image theory? As Whitney Davis has argued, visuality and pictoriality are reciprocally and recursively interdetermined and interacting aspects of world recognition. Yet according to this formulation, the feretory represents a prosthesis carefully engineered to collapse pictoriality and visuality. By Davis's account, this is what he says, tantamount to converting image into pure seeing, such that the world is a picture, end quote. Indeed, as noted before, according to the doctrinal discourse from which this icon stems, that is precisely the point. The phenomenal world is a picture. Visuality is to vision in Bildwissenschaft as the mind stands in relationship to all sensory input in the Shingon Buddhist episteme. Put reductively, the mind determines one perception of all phenomena in Shingon Buddhism. Thus, in this manner, the image has nothing to do with irrealism. It is the foundation of the potential to grasp the imagistic and illusory nature of reality itself. It is only through representation, one might say, that reality becomes perceptible. There are further consequences. We're perhaps used to thinking of pictures as a moment within a visual relay that allows for interpersonal meaning. The picture is the stage at which the image is manipulatable, material, haptic, and perhaps most crucially subject to aspectual spatialized gaze. But just as the image upon the meditation upon the aqua glyph was meant to show the illusory nature of semiosis, so too is the feretory constructed to take advantage of the aqua icon to show the illusory nature of vision. It is thus a pictorial artifact that is both interpersonal and perhaps anti-cultural, in that it shorts the pictorial and visual recursion to create a gyroscopic stasis. Moreover, as an iconotext, it is a glyph that is also the body of the deity. It operates precisely at the intersection of semiotics and image studies, an intersection that gives one pause, again, if we are to consider Bildwissenschaft and visual culture as turns away from semiotics and linguistic analysis. In sum, this talk perhaps raises more questions than it does provide answers. And I must confess that I'm still in the early stages of grappling with what the language of Bildwissenschaft would mean for the future of the study of Japanese artifacts. Yet, as I hope to have demonstrated, the potential for the discourse of Bildwissenschaft is far wider than a transatlantic dialogue might presuppose. It is a framework that allows us to bridge the post and pre-modern, the extra-modern, perhaps, with sufficient malleability to encompass quite wide cultural and historical contextual constraints. What is wanting, it seems to me, is an agreed-upon understanding of how to use the words of our contemporary analytic discourse so that we can begin to speak meaningfully of plural systems of meaning. This returns to what Bayata mentioned yesterday with the double movement. And to sum this up, I think that the problem isn't history. The problem is us. We don't know how we feel about images. So until we know how we feel about them and can discuss them meaningfully, we're not going to be able to talk about historical forms of them. Put differently, as a scholar of non-Western art, I'm optimistic that we might arrive at such a conceptual framework for the historical excavation of multiple image theories that are trans-historical, transatlantic, and trans-Pacific. Likewise, if one aspires to a universalist image science or image theory, I believe its realization cannot rest upon interdisciplinarity. And this is a comment I make in response to what Geiger has called the synthetic approach of Bildwissenschaft. It is perhaps not new disciplines, CT scans, oil paintings, diagrams that need to be brought into concert, but new discursive historical context that will provide more revelatory insights for our field. For as the Feretory reveals, the image theory we purport to establish is not the first historical theory of the image that accounted for the co-constitutive and transmedial nature of the image. And just as these image theories can shed light on medieval pictoriality, so too can these historical image theories provide guidance for the understanding of both the horizons of the image and the future of our discipline.